The first speaker, it's our honor to announce, will be Hermann Nicolai. And he had a very distinguished career in quantum gravity and is well known for the development of N equal 8 supergravity, the study of cosmic billiards and exceptional Lie algebras, and conformal symmetry in quantum gravity. And Hermann is a director at the Albert Einstein Institute in Potsdam. And as such, he has founded and led the division, which is called Quantum Gravity and Unified Series, from 1997 on. So many of us have spent some time and enjoyed our time there. And through the years, he has supported researchers from a wide variety of approaches. So I think Hermann will give a personal overview of quantum gravity with the title Approaches to Quantum Gravity, Key Achievements and Open Issues. So this talk will be 50 minutes and we will have afterwards a 10 minute period for questions. Note that we have also the Slack channel for questions and discussions of the talk, and I posted the link to the Slack channel in the chat. And Hermann will not take questions during the talk. You can collect questions in the chat channel. Please don't use it for lengthy side discussions out of respect for the speaker. And we will then sort through these questions in the questions period.
Okay, so good morning, everyone, or good afternoon. I would first of all like to thank Bianca and the organizers for giving me this opportunity to present this overview talk. I had actually been looking forward to my first visit to Perimeter Institute, but now for well-known reasons, this experience has been replaced with the experience of giving my first online conference talk. So I've been asked to review some approaches to quantum gravity, highlighting some achievements and also the open issues. And I would like to start with a word of caution. Efforts to find a theory of quantum gravity have been going on for, depending on how you count, 50 years or even more. As a result of which there are now several very well developed approaches. There's also a multitude of promising ideas and onsets, but what we're lacking so far is any consensus on what is the right answer. And in fact, also from my experience, I know that there's not so much communication across the fence between the different approaches, this conference actually being one of the notable exceptions. The other point is that, unfortunately, nature has remained largely silent about what comes after the Einstein and the standard model of particle physics. As you know, there's now a wealth of new data from astrophysics, gravitational waves, dark matter surges, particle physics, and so on. But so far, almost no evidence for new physics. And the task is not made easier by the fact that the relevant constant, I mean the Planck scale, is so small as to remain inaccessible for the very far into the future. And one of the results of this is that so far none of the approaches has been able to come up with what's called an experimentum crucis in the old days, I mean some kind of experiment with which you can either validate or falsify that particular approach. So we should not exclude the possibility that this endeavor will end like this biblical event of some 5,000 years ago. There you also had a lot of people working towards the same goal, in fact, but the effort failed because of a complete breakdown of communication. And therefore, I would commend the organizers again for organizing this such a sort of synergistic conference, and I hope there will be very good discussions. And I think it's also important to try to get to the bottom of things. So there's a vast amount of material, as I said, after all 50 years of an unprecedented intellectual, collective intellectual effort. So I decided to pick a few key issues. This is certainly not a complete list. And even in what I'm going to say, I think this will, in parts, very incomplete, but I can refer to the other overview talks and also to some of the panel discussions, or all the panel discussions at this conference, for extra and I hope more complete information. I should also apologize in advance with regard to giving credit and references. With such a vast subject, it's just not possible to do justice. Either you give too few or too many references. I've sort of opted for giving fewer references, but as I said, I apologize in advance. Also, I should say that I will not completely hide my own preferences. So here we have six topics, and I will spend much time on the first because UV completeness is certainly a key issue. And to start with, let me recall what the problem is. And this is something everybody knows. Perturbative quantum gravity is not renormalizable, unlike the other forces of nature. And that makes a crucial difference also in our approaches to quantizing this theory. In particular, even if you remove the divergences order by order in perturbation theory, you're left with infinitely many ambiguities and thus a loss of predictivity. Now, as you all know, there's a bit of a schism in the quantum gravity community, and this schism or the big divide is really the result of drawing two completely opposite conclusions from this basic fact. Now, the first conclusion is that you would simply say that Einstein's theories is just no good at the very smallest distances and has to be replaced by a radically different theory at the very shortest distances. That sort of overcomes quantum gravity, classical general relativity, and so on, and has a completely different form. The other point of view is that these ultraviolet divergences are merely an artifact of the perturbative treatment. There's also something to say for this, because after all, perturbative treatment does violence to some of the beautiful features of Einstein's theory. And if true, then that would mean that quantum gravity can stand on its own feet upon proper non-perturbative quantization. As you will see, this does not necessarily mean that at the end of this quantization procedure, you will be able to recognize the starting point, but we will see. So I've decided just to pick four main topics here, just to tell you briefly how they approach this problem. But of course, you should all be aware that this is really a tall order, because unlike previous theories of physics, this theory is supposed to be valid to arbitrarily small scales. We have not had such a theory so far in physics. So let me start out with the superstring theory, which is by many considered to be the leading contender in the race for quantum gravity. Now, I'm sure you all know that string theory is formulated as or starts from a two-dimensional world sheet of theory of quantum gravity. And the magic of this is that the quantum gravity path integral, due to the symmetries that the theory has, namely two-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance and conformal invariance, can be by a choice of gauge reduced to a finite dimensional integral. You can see this, right? So that's a huge difference. Rather than with a functional integral, you have to deal only with a finite dimensional integral, which is still very complicated. But the structure then of a typical quantity in string theory and amplitude, for example, is the following. You have a sum, an infinite sum. So GS is the string coupling constant. And then here you have an expectation value, which is a conformal field theory correlator that lives on the Riemann surface of genus G. And then here you insert the vertex operators corresponding to those particles or objects whose from which you want to calculate the amplitude. And after doing this gauge fixing, so on, as I said, you're left with a finite dimensional integral over a certain moduli space for n punctures. It's the moduli space of supermoduli space of n punctured Riemann surfaces of genus G with a suitable measure. Now, in this form, in fact, there are no ultraviolet divergences. You cannot see them. One way to understand this, how they get lost in the transition from quantum field theory, is to go to Feynman parameters to exploit the modular invariance and to see that the integral just becomes finite. There is no divergent integral of a momentum space anymore. However, in the presence of tachyons, the theory does have infrared divergences. And this means that this integral here over moduli space can diverge at the cusps. And this happens when there's a tachyon, which is also associated with a vacuum instability. This is the main reason that string theory has to go supersymmetric. So it's not the fact that you want to cancel bosons and fermion amplitudes, but it's the fact that supersymmetric theories have positive Hamiltonians. So with a supersymmetric vacuum, you can avoid this problem. So the state of the art, of course, there's been an enormous amount of work on this, on conformal field theory in general, and there's a lot known about conformal field theory correlators. There's a bootstrap program. There are all kinds of technical advances, but it's still difficult to do these calculations for curved backgrounds, in particular most celebrated example is ADS5 cross S5. It also becomes difficult to evaluate these correlators for increasing genus. And there's also very peculiar difficulty here in connection with the supermoduli space, which says that it's no longer split, which means that in some sense the Fubini theorem doesn't hold anymore. You can no longer factorize this integral of the bosonic and fermionic parts because the supermoduli are twisted over the moduli space. So this is an extra complication. And for this reason, there are general results about higher genus in superstring theory. But as far as I know, only up to G equals 2 has this been fully worked out. This infinite sum over the genera does not converge. It doesn't converge for bosonic strings and probably does not converge for superstrings. There's the issue, what's the role of supersymmetry? Can we deal with non-supersymmetric background in this formalism? And I should also say that there's even at genus 1, the mathematics gets very, very sophisticated. So if can advertise a book has recently appeared on Eisenstein's theories and automorphic representations, and that's just genus 1. So to summarize, and none of the experts doubts that this will work, but the path forward is, of course, somewhat obstructed by extremely difficult technical issues, and it may well take a few decades to really get a more global understanding of what the situation is. N equals 8 supergravity, that was favored some 40 years ago because people thought, well, maybe there is a quantum field theory extension of Einstein's theory that's finite to all orders. And that's, of course, the main candidate with this famous spectrum. And early on, it was already realized that the theory, the supersymmetry may not be enough to guarantee finiteness of the theory. However, due to the work in particular of these people here, we now know that the theory is much more finite than expected. Up to 4 loops, it actually behaves like super young Hills. And if it continued to do so, it would actually be finite to all orders. But a recent computation at 5 loops, by the way, an amazing achievement, I should say, has revealed a divergence already. Well, this is in dimensional regularization. In critical dimension, 24/5. And this is the formula that relates the conjecture formula relating critical dimension to the loop number. And you see here that with this, you would expect divergence to appear in 7 loops. However, the situation is not so clear cut, because you can also discuss the thing from the point of view of counter terms. And it is also a fact that at this time, no fully supersymmetric, fully 7 invariant counter term is known, which you might take as a hint that it might be finite after all. Of course, again, the very difficult question here, but it seems, I would say that even, you know, if it's finite, we need some additional insights that we haven't had so far yet. So the question of ultraviolet finiteness of n equals 8 supergravity is still up in the air, and I would think that it will remain up in the air for some time to come, until somebody actually does the 7-loop calculation and exposes the divergence. The third item is asymptotic safety. This is now a completely different idea. And I should like to say that if this is really true, I mean, this approach is closest in spirit to conventional quantum field theory ideas, very conservative. But if it's true, then we don't need any fancy schemes beyond quantum field theory. And the main postulate here, or the main conjecture here, is that although quantum gravity looks perturbatively non-renormalizable, it is renormalizable in disguise, in the sense that you can make it UV, is UV complete, if you, instead of just the Newton coupling, there's a finite number of coupling constants multiplying higher order curvature invariants that need to be fixed, and then you can take the ultraviolet limit. Well, of course, as I said, there's all these ideas about renormalization group flow and renormalization group equations, and so on. If we look out of the window, we don't see any running of the coupling, gravitational coupling. But this is due to the fact that the Planck mass here is analogous to lambda QCD. It's the lower end of the asymptotic scaling regime. So that makes it a challenge to come up with a true prediction of this scheme. I'm sure you will hear more about this from Frank Sauer-Essig. So there's been a lot of work on, especially in recent years, and many models have been investigated, and there's substantial evidence for the existence of such a fixed point. This picture is one of the very early ones from Martin Reuter's early work. Here you just have the Newton coupling constant and the cosmological constant. Of course, picture would more look more complicated if you include higher order couplings. The issues here are, first of all, how to go beyond the circumstantial evidence, how to really prove that in infinite dimensional space of couplings, there's such a stable hypersurface. There's an issue with unitarity and ghosts for higher derivative couplings, which, as you may know, that R squared, Riemann squared, cubed, and so on couplings are usually fraught come with ghosts. Thirdly, much of this work is in the Euclidean domain. And I should say, it's not so easy here to go from Euclidean to Lorentzian. It's not just simply putting factors of I in some places. There's no such thing as the Osterwalder-Schrader reconstruction theorem as we have it for quantum flat space, quantum field theory. And one may expect that these two, Euclidean quantum gravity and Lorentzian quantum gravity, are two completely different things. The questions with regard to the meaning and the universality of these running coupling constants that are studied within this approach. And this has been, there's been a recent debate, so a critique from John Donoghue and a reply from the experts. Loop quantum gravity, that's the fourth item I want to discuss here. And here we are dealing with a very different quantization scheme. And this means that some issues concerning ultraviolet divergences are often obscured. And this is due to the fact that the kinematical Hilbert space in this approach is non-separable. What this means is the following. In quantum mechanics, we normalize, usually normalize position eigenstates like this. But this is then replaced by what's sometimes called Bohr compactification of the real line. You replace this product of two position eigenstates by this product, thereby, in some sense, pulverizing space. And as you can see in this case, the basis of the Hilbert space is uncountable. And this is what non-separable means here. So it's a very unusual approach. And there are also some very special features that come with it. Operators are not weakly continuous. So when you vary matrix elements as function of some parameter, they're not continuous functions. You cannot see ultraviolet divergences in this approach, at least not in any conventional sense, because the ultraviolet divergences usually appear via products of distributions, which we're not allowed to multiply. As you can see, you will never get a product of delta functions like this. And the third unusual feature is that in this approach, even though we're dealing with the gauge theory, there are no negative norm states from the outset. I think that this is, not seeing the ultraviolet divergences is maybe a little bit too easy a resolution, because if loop quantum gravity is ever to recover a semi-classical space-time and the classical Einstein equations in, say, flat space, it must eventually phase up to this non-renormalizability problem, at least in terms of the effective field theory that comes out of this. If successful, I think the only way this can work is that actually loop quantum gravity reduces to some version of asymptotic safety. Here, I just want to flash the Hamiltonian constraint. The main achievement here is that actually the Hamiltonian constraint is mathematically well-defined as an operator, which is the thing that never really worked in the old-fashioned Wheeler-DeWitt approach. But there remain various very technical issues, for example, domain questions. You would have to be able to apply Hamiltonian twice in order to check the diffeomorphism algebra, et cetera, et cetera. So it becomes very involved. And there are also some doubts that this is actually the physically correct Hamiltonian, because if you work out what it does on some given spin network, you find it acts very, very locally. So loop quantum gravity researchers, or at least some of them, have now moved to spin forms and also group field theory, which can be regarded as a covariant version of loop quantum gravity. And we will hear about this, I suppose, from Alejandro Perez. It's best to think of this as something that's inspired by loop quantum gravity, but there's no rigorous link. So the aim is to emulate in a rigorous way the formal gravitational path integral. We have a space-time slab with a spatial metric initially and final spatial metric, and then you integrate formally over all the intermediate fields in the space-time slab. This is, of course, highly ill-defined, but here one tries to make it well-defined by replacing these boundary metrics by boundary spin networks, and one interpolates between them, not with some continuous spectrum of fields, but with a so-called spin foam. And so you have, this is a new way to define lattice models of quantum gravity, which exist in their own right. My question here, and I've not been able to get a really good answer to this, is in doing this calculation, is one supposed to sum over all spin foams? This would be an uncountable sum, clearly. Or is one supposed to take a refinement limit? I suppose that Alejandro will maybe be able to say more about this. There are other discrete options here, but I leave it to Renate Lohl and Surya to speak about their approaches. So there's also this issue about perturbative versus non-perturbative. Perturbative meaning that I start from some completely solvable theory, like a free theory, and then expand about some parameter. So it has to be said that the non-string approaches are usually non-perturbative up initio in this sense, that they do not expand about an exactly solved theory, which, by the way, is also true for the original Wheeler-DeWitt equation, if you could make it well-defined. But these approaches usually have some difficulties with the sort of connecting to continuous field theory, the continuum Einstein equations in particular. And this, I think, sadly for loop quantum gravity, remains an outstanding problem, how to recover smooth space-time in such a limit. String theory, as you know, is, by contrast, is the very way in which it's been set up is in terms of perturbing about free theory, and so it is a perturbative expansion in string loops, and also about a given background space-time. That is something, you know, we still don't know what the non-perturbative, full non-perturbative formulation of that theory is. It's sometimes called M theory. But there has been some progress in recent decades, I should say, which mainly comes from exploiting duality symmetries that relate strong and weakly coupled phases of the theory. So you can describe a strongly coupled phase of the theory in terms of a dual weakly coupled phase. In ADS-CFT, one of the major progresses has been via the integrability program, where one has been able to actually interpolate between weak and strong coupling. I just would like to make a remark here, because one often hears that non-perturbative quantum gravity in ADS bulk is defined by the duality in terms of the boundary Super-Young-Mills theory. I should say that, in my opinion, this would also require non-perturbative formulation or construction of that theory, and that is not yet available in the sense of, you know, Whiteman field theory or maybe the conformal bootstrap program. Asymptotic safety, again, is a priori non-perturbative, but the severe truncations you have to perform in order to actually do some calculations make this, at least in my view, make this approach de facto perturbative. So one sadly needs several new important insights here. I just wanted to comment a little bit on the, coming back to string theory, strong coupling limit of superstring theory. Here you see a picture or image that I took out of a set of lectures by Thibaut Damour. What you see here is on the left, so this is string coupling. This is the free string with a massive excited tower of states. And what happens, according to this picture, is that as you switch on the string coupling constants, that the levels split up and finally merge into a continuum. And as Witten observed a long time ago, as you take the strong coupling linear string theory, it's like an extra dimension opening up. And this is what leads from 10 to 11 dimensions, 11-dimensional M theory. And well, that's my personal opinion, if you like, is that what this really means is that in the non-perturbative sector, you should replace the super string by the super membrane. You should think of this Bergstrom Sesskind Townsend. The super membrane can be regarded in some sense as the non-perturbative description of the super string. Of course, supermembrane theory is even harder than string theory, but one development that grew out of this was this maximally supersymmetric SU infinity matrix model that we discovered long ago in connection with the supermembrane, and that reappeared later in a somewhat different guise in connection with the interpretation of T0 brains. I will not say very much on the conceptual issues because of quantum gravity, because these are questions that have been around for almost, well, certainly for 50 years. So let me just flash them. One is the question, can we really make sense of the gravitational path integral beyond mere heuristics and Gedanken mathematics. It's being used a lot these days, but as I said, merely at a heuristic level, because in order to make it well-defined, it's even harder than make a functional integral well-defined in quantum field theory. So some of the approaches like spin foams or causal dynamical triangulations can be regarded as an effort in this direction. This is related to setting up, interpreting the Wheeler-DeWitt equation beyond the mathematical problems. Namely, the question here is what, and this is still not quite clear, what's the physical interpretation of this wave function of the universe? In the sense that even if somebody succeeded in making this well-defined and calculating the wave function of the universe, what would that really mean? And this raises the question whether we have the correct interpretation of quantum mechanics, or is the question is even whether quantum mechanics is the right framework, or whether it must also be modified. This is a point of view that's also being pushed by Roger Penrose. Well, black hole information paradox. I will not say very much because you will have talks here, because I would just expose my confusion on the subject, which incidentally tends to agree with every seminar here on this topic. But I hope that we'll have some elucidation here. Background independence is another big topic. Again, I don't want to say too much because I would have to go to too much detail. This is a definition that I took from Wikipedia. I leave it to you to make to figure out what is being said here. But in pedestrian terms, what it means is that the proper formulation of quantum gravity should not depend on a given space-time metric or any other given background structure. I think everybody would agree on this desideratum, but it may not be easy to achieve. And the other point I want to raise is that maybe one should not be too dogmatic here. If in some approaches you allow yourself only to work with gauge invariant, background independent quantities, you may miss some of the important physics. For this, I show what you see here is the this is the diagram for the top quark resonance. This is something one sees in the experiment, but everybody knows that the top quark is not a gauge invariant state. So maybe, in quantum field theory, one usually breaks the gauge invariance, the background invariance, but one does the calculation, and then only at the end of the day, you verify that the theory is actually gauge independent. So that's just a comment. Well, emergence, because this is one of the hot topics these days in quantum gravity, and it is definitely a very sexy idea. The idea is somehow that we should think of classical general relativity, quantum field theory, as effective low energy theories in the same sense as fluid mechanics is sort of effective theory of some underlying theory in terms of molecules and atoms. And so the question is really, and that also goes back to my initial comments about ultraviolet completeness, the real question is, or the question really is, emergence from what? Or what are the fundamental quantum gravity degrees of freedom? And if you shop around in the different approaches, there's many things on offer. For example, in string theory, you may get the impression it's just a zoology of all kinds of brains. BPS solutions, are these the fundamental objects, fundamental degrees of quantum gravity? Or in context of the ADS-CFT correspondence, is the real theory the boundary quantum field theory and the bulk theory, the bulk of quantum gravity, simply a manifestation, a holographic manifestation of boundary quantum field theory? There's a lot of talk about quantum gravity and quantum information. I guess we will hear about this later today. There's this idea of getting quantum gravity from thermodynamics. This goes back to early work by Thibaut d'Amour, and that's work by Ted Jacobson and later work. And finally, there are also some more, ideas that are less in the focus from Daniele Auriti. I always hear about space-time atoms in the group field theory approach. Tuft has at some point advocated the idea that everything is just a cellular automaton. So you see there's a bewildering array of possibilities here. And so let me just say a few things about this topic, because it's very hot topic. It's also, I guess, going to be covered in several talks and parallel sessions. Namely the link between quantum gravity and quantum information theory. Quite generally speaking, the effort here is to somehow relate concepts of quantum information theory to geometry, and most famously in this work by Ryo Takayanagi, where one has a direct geometrical realization of the entanglement entropy in the boundary quantum field theory via minimal surfaces in, that extend into ADS. So there's a lot of work on this, and as I said, you will probably hear more about this. There's also some very intriguing work that I learned about very recently, namely the question whether one can explain this famous Hawking, this page curve in the Hawking evaporation of black holes. And the one thing that I've picked up from this is that after all the debate about firewalls, now it turns out there are no firewalls. I suspect that this is not yet the last word on this issue, but certainly very interesting developments. There are also other ideas about, you know, getting geometry from, you know, very abstractly defined quantum mechanical systems, like in the SYK model. But one thing I would like to point out here, historical note, is that the idea that physics at the most fundamental level should be formulated in terms of quantum bits is due to von Weizsäcker back in 1958. Of course, he didn't call it quantum bits, and also the link with geometry was not yet there. I would like to add one more issue to this, one more option for this emergence. Namely, this is work I've been involved in with Thibaut d'Amour and Marc Henault. This goes back to sort of more conventional approach to quantum gravity, where you think of the cosmological evolution as evolution in a moduli space of one-dimensional motion, the moduli space of three metrics. And the new thing here is that a BKL type analysis of Einstein's equations in the near singularity limit has revealed the emergence of a presence of a huge, monstrously infinite dimensional symmetry, Kac-Moody symmetry of indefinite type. And so this has led to the proposal that one should replace this moduli space by a group theoretical construct involving this maximally extended hyperbolic Kac-Moody algebra. I should say that this is, you know, this is still a long way to go, also because we know next to nothing about this the algebra. It's one of the enigmas of current mathematics, but this would be a new kind of holographic correspondence where the space-time dependence geometry gets encoded or spread over an infinite dimensional Lie algebra. So finally, I think I'm doing fine with time. I want to say about a few words about the real world, because after all, we have beautiful theories, but in physics, the final arbiter is experiment and observation. So the key questions to anyone proposing a theory of quantum gravity is, how can you validate or refute or falsify that particular ansatz? So I've listed a few possibilities here. One is that there are genuinely new effects, like superpartners, large extra dimensions, test scale quantum gravity. There may be new interesting dark matter candidates, or maybe even things like deforming gravity, modified theories of gravity. This could also be listed in this connection. In fact, to turn it around, suppose LHC had discovered superpartners, then many people would have taken this as evidence towards supergravity, superstring theory. Much harder is, of course, would be to identify indirect effects. Maybe you can read the hints in the CMB. That's more difficult. Or also cumulative effects. Like a few years ago, there was speculation about deforming relativistic dispersion relations by sort of having effect where effect builds up over 10 billion years. There's, of course, cosmology. I guess there will be more information at this conference. For example, well, inflation is not really a theory, it's more like a framework. And in the string theory currently, there's a debate between people claiming that the Sitter space is not consistent with string theory versus those people who claim it is. That's still ongoing. A very interesting new avenue for experimental verification is now the strong gravity regime that has opened up with the discovery of gravitational waves. So you will hear this about this from Maya, maybe also from Hermann Berlinde. I'm not quite sure from this talk title whether this is what it's going to be. I also know that Steve Giddings has been working in these directions, although his title doesn't quite sound like it. And then, of course, there's the standard model. What we have now the results from LHC, what do they imply? Now, this is what I will be concentrating on the rest of this talk. But the important thing I would emphasize here is it's not just enough to produce some prediction, like, for example, deformed dispersion relations, but you also have to be able to discriminate your prediction from somebody else's prediction that sort of coincides with yours. As we all know, such effects can also be very often simply or masked or simply explained in terms of dust or there may be much more mundane explanations of the effects. So this, I think this will not be easy. So, you know, one possible access is, of course, to go back to the standard model and say what your approach has to say about low energy particle physics. Now, I'm sure you've seen all these diagrams, which I've downloaded from, that's actually from 2017. This is the SUSY surges, and this is the exotic surges, and you see that there's nothing but exclusion limits here. Much to the disappointment of many of my colleagues, but nature has its own way of doing things. Anyway, so what this means is that at least in particle physics, there's no hint whatsoever of new physics in this. And what's more is that if you follow the, now that we know the top quark mass and the Higgs mass, if you follow the RG evolutions of these standard model couplings, it turns out they're just tuned in such a way that there's in principle no obstacle towards taking the theory all the way up to the Planck scale. So from that point of view, there's not even no obvious need for new kinds of particles just above the scale that we're currently probing. So the conclusion at this time is at least that the standard model could survive unscathed, more or less unscathed, all the way to the Planck scale. Now, what does string theory have to say about this? I should say, string theory is much more ambitious than other approaches. Other approaches will not say much about low energy particle physics, but string theory also has the ambition to unify everything. Now, it's been known for a very long time that string theory emits a large number of vacua. So here's a very nice article. Actually, Bertz Heligans was the very first person to point out the potential importance of the multiverse interpretation of string theory. His bad luck was that he announced this in an inaugural lecture, which was given in Dutch, and I published in Dutch, so I don't think many people read it. So there was already a very large number here, but it has recently gone up to this even larger number, of which gives the latest estimate on how many vacua there are in string theory. And they typically come with gauge groups like this, which look also a bit monstrous. Now, even though there are so many, it's not even clear whether the standard model is contained in this set. By this, I do not mean it's trivial to embed the standard model gauge group in this, but what I mean is if it's really true that there's not much between the standard model and the Planck scale, how does this, can you fit this in into this kind of prescription? At any rate, it is presently not known which of these vacua are really viable, and that has given rise to a sort of massive effort in order to curtail the proliferation of string vacua, to an effort to find or identifying criteria which would allow us to eliminate ultraviolet incomplete theories from those that can be embedded into string theory. And there's a huge activity. Like if you look at this last string failure meeting, most of it was about the swampland program. So there's the weak gravity conjecture, absence of global symmetry, and maybe others. But at this time, I don't think one can say whether this will eventually succeed or not. If it does not, it means that we must look for very, very different and new and better ways to link string theory to the real world. Now, this is not a reason for schadenfreude or to rejoice for the other approaches. Indeed, they also suffer from a huge number of possibilities, ambiguities, which is sort of, the non-string analog of the proliferation of string vacua, which are such that also for these approaches, you cannot really at this time produce a kind of testable prediction, this experimentum crucis with which the theory will stand or fall. There's a huge number of ambiguities in loop corner gravity. Of course, this is a bit up to debate because some of the proponents would sort of contest this claim. But for example, the usual quantization ambiguities that you already have in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. But then there's also a question whether Hamiltonian is the correct one or do you need a much more complicated one? That's not so clear. There's a large number of possibilities for lattice models. For example, if you start allowing bigger balances for spin form vertices and so on. And here as well, there may be many more possibilities than you would like. In fact, I've been sitting in on quite a number of talks, and there were always sort of success stories. And I was sitting and asking myself, well, this seems to be working too well. I think, you should start looking for some inconsistencies to cut down on this embarras de richesse. So this is really a question to everyone here. Suppose you have your favorite approach to quantum gravity with all these ambiguities. Do you think that nature picks the right answer just at random from a huge variety of possibilities? Or are there further criteria to narrow down the number of possible choices? As I said, the Swampland program is a little bit of an attempt in this direction. Now for the last, as I said, I do not want to hide my personal preferences completely. So in the last two slides, I want to tell you about something else, which could mean that this goes in a completely different way. And this is going back to N equals 8 supergravity, which in the early 80s was thought to be a leading approach and for the unification of gravity with the other interactions. And this is sort of the last stage of this. This is a proposal by Murray Gell-Mann in 1983, which he proposed, as he described it, as a last-ditch attempt to salvage the Hablon interpretation of N equals 8 supergravity. And what it is the following. The theory has 56 spin 1/2 fermions, and if you remove 8 Goldsteinos to send the gravitinos up to the Planck mass, you're left with 48 spin 1/2 fermions, which is exactly the right number to match the content of the standard model, including right-handed neutrinos. He described as left-handed antineutrinos. And there was, he also achieved a sort of partial matching of the quantum numbers. Let's just look at this. These are the U1 charges that you would get from N equals 8 supergravity. These are the electric charges of the quarks and leptons, which you see here. And he noticed that if you, there's a systematic way of adding a spurion charge in such a way to rectify this. So so that stood for many years as a kind of, you know, coincidence, could just be a mirage. However, because in those days, everybody was expecting that once you switch on LHC, you will see a plethora of new fundamental spin 1/2 particles. But this hasn't happened, and this has recently prompted us to look again at this. And it turns out that you can actually, at least at the level of the group theory, rectify this mismatch. But for this, you have to go beyond N equals 8 supergravity. This cannot be rectified within N equals 8 supergravity. You have to go beyond. And it turns out that actually this huge symmetry can do the job for you. What I find intriguing here is the possibility that in order to match the low energy theory with whatever theory there is at the Planck scale, it may actually require us to go infinite dimensional. And my last slide, this is work I've been recently involved in with Krzysztof Meissner, because we said, well, let's take this seriously. Then you also have these 8 supermassive gravitinos. And this is, well, some of you made, I think my N equals 1 super MSSM model builders think it would think of this as completely crazy. But anyway, you now have fractionally charged massive gravitinos participating in standard model interactions. And that's certainly a very unusual feature, which could, in fact, lead to new kinds of tests. Because if these things are absolutely stable against decays in the standard model matter because of their quantum numbers, which, by the way, include this Gell-Mann-Spurion shift, as I should add. And so you have a new and novel, unusual dark matter candidate. They're very rare. So if you put up a detector, you probably will not see them. But people have been talking about paleo detectors, so maybe there's a possibility here. There's also some unexplained physics that's a little bit out of the focus of quantum gravity people, namely the existence of ultra-high energy cosmic rays that could be explained by this. And I hope we will have soon have a paper out on how to use these super heavy objects as seeds for primordial black holes. Because this is another big puzzle of astrophysics, why there are 60 billion solar mass black holes in the early universe that cannot form by standard stellar processes. So I'm just saying, I mean, this, whether this is correct or not remains to be seen, but I just want to put this up in order to alert you to the fact that there may be yet different ways and means to test your favorite theory of quantum gravity. So I'm finished, precisely 50 minutes. So let me quickly summarize. There's been really a stupendous amount of work and a great diversity of results over the past 50 years. I don't think there's ever been an effort in the theoretical mathematical sciences that matches this effort in terms of a collective intellectual enterprise. So it's stunning, but it's even more stunning that we still haven't reached a consensus here, and we may still be quite far from the correct answer. And in fact, you know, I find it at the moment, I find it actually hard to see how all of this could and should fit together, because I think of the early days in quantum mechanics when Schrödinger came with his wave equation and Heisenberg invented matrix mechanics, and then for a while it was thought that these were completely different approaches to solving the problem of quantum theory. But happily, after half a year or so, it turned out that they realized it was just the same theory. We're still very far away from this state of affairs. And this is why I want to commend the organizers again for organizing these conferences. We have to keep talking to one another, and we should also be able to ask quote-unquote stupid questions in an effort to get to the bottom of things. But finally, whatever it is, however it works out, I think we're still in bad need of some unmistakable hint from experiment and observation. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Hermann, for this comprehensive talk. Unfortunately, the applause function doesn't really work. You can use the reactions button, actually. So we have now a question period, so you can use a raised hand feature to raise your hand.
So should I now stop share, or how are we going to do this?
You can keep sharing, I think, if
just
there's a question to
them.
your slides. There was one question really from the chat by Ted.
Yes.
I'm not sure, Ted. I try to unmute Ted Jacobson. Do you want to ask it in person?
Yes, please.
Okay, it was actually not such an interesting question compared to the others, but I just was wondering, could you elaborate a little bit, in what sense is N equals 4 supergravity conformal field theory, you know, not completely well-defined?
Well, I mean, in the sense of constructive quantum fields here, there's a lot of work on, a lot is known about the perturbation theory, and there's also a lot known, I mean, even beyond perturbation theory, especially from this integrability program, where, as I said, one can connect a small and large coupling regimes and even interpolate between them. But what I mean is that if you try to non-perturbatively construct a theory, then you can try to put it on the lattice, for example, and then see whether the limit exists. But this hasn't been done. Not least because by putting the theory on the lattice, of course, you destroy much of the symmetry of the theory. So you may say that I'm a little bit trying to be too rigorous here, but I'm sort of seeing this in the same vein as the program in constructive quantum field theory. People actually try to prove the existence of phi to the fourth or Yukawa theory. And as you know, in four dimensions, there's not been so much progress on this. So maybe you could say that I'm asking too much, and that one could adopt a more pragmatic attitude and say, well, we know so many things about the theory. Let's just go ahead and study it. And yes, of course, that's, of course, a valid point of view.
Okay, the next one asking a question will be Lee. Which I still have to try to unmute you.
There, can you hear me?
Yes, yeah. I can hear you and see you. Hi.
Yes, hi, Hermann. I want to first of all thank you for your survey. I think on the whole you were very fair. There are details about things I know about. Of course, I don't know many things, where I would say things very differently than how you say things. But overall, I think you were fair and you hit many, many important points. And I'd like to commend you for that. And particularly when you came to loop quantum gravity, you did something that I hope we'll all be doing in this conference, which is there's a way in which you put yourself in their shoes. And you said, supposing this would work, what would be a consequence of that? And you said, asymptotic freedom would have to be a consequence of that.
Safety.
Asymptotic safety, I'm sorry. And that's something I hope that we all do, is put ourselves in each other's shoes and try to see how we can use ideas from the different areas to make something work. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so no question, Lee.
I can always ask a question, you know, Bianca, but I think that was important to say.
Okay, we go on to Eric Curiel. You are unmuted.
Hi, Herman, can you hear me?
Yes, hi.
I want to join Lee in thanking you for the talk. It was masterful. I learned a tremendous amount. My question is, so I really liked your point that a program in quantum gravity must produce not only some testable prediction, but also a way to discriminate its predictions or explanations from other programs. And this clearly can't come from black hole thermodynamics, because everyone agrees on that. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, on your view, do some programs do a better job than others at producing potentially discriminatory predictions or explanations? And if so, why? Or if so, why not?
Well, I think if you just stay within the confines of gravity, then it's of course more difficult to come up with a prediction. If you, in the framework of it, you know, unification framework, then of course you also, like string theory, tries to make predictions with regard to the low energy standard model, which is of course goes much farther. If I just stay with this, with quantum gravity, it will be difficult because, you know, I'm aware that, for example, in loop quantum cosmology, that people try to make or gain some understanding of the early universe and maybe the origin of inflation. But this is precisely one of the points where it will be difficult to sort of discriminate your approach from somebody else's approach, who also makes predictions about the early universe. And as you know, for example, when it comes to inflationary models, there are zillions of them. And I mean, beyond, you know, fitting the data, which of course this framework does very well, but if you try to go deeper and, for example, ask the question, where does the inflaton come from? How does it fit in your framework? Then it becomes much more difficult. So, and this is why I said, I want to say it again, the difficulty is not only to come up with a prediction about this or that evolution of the early universe, but the challenge is also to do it in such a way that you can say, you know, my approach predicts such and such a thing, which is something no other approach predicts. So that's even more difficult. But I think you have to keep trying. And in fact, you know, with the gravitational wave observations, I think it's a bit unlikely, but I think there's still some hope that by making better and better observations, we may see features of black holes and the black hole horizons that may sort of provide insights into quantum gravity. I mean, like this, now the firewall is gone as far as I understand, but if it had been there, then, you know, maybe you could have detected signs of it, some signature by looking and probing black hole collisions.
Thank you.
Okay, so last question by Dan Harlow.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to make a comment about this experimental prediction. So I would say that before we worry about new experimental predictions, none of the candidates you mentioned are able to, so far, it's not been shown that any of the candidates you mentioned are able to reproduce just ordinary four-dimensional general relativity with realistic particle physics. String yes. theory can sort of almost do it, but it has, well, the particle physics is wrong. It has too much supersymmetry. So, until we can get that, I would say the problem is not a lack of experimental predictions. We're really limited by theory because we don't have any theory that fits the data that we already have. So we don't need more data even yet. We just have to first explain the data we already have.
Well, it's true. I mean, but I'm sure you would agree that if supersymmetry had been discovered at LHC, then many people would have said, I said this before, many people would have taken this as, some evidence towards supergravity and superstring theory. And the same thing with certain dark matter candidates. If they had found a WIMP candidate that fits with a supersymmetric model, then that would have been a prediction that would have been confirmed by, that could have been confirmed by experiment. And as you know, at the moment, I think they're trying to improve these WIMP searches even further. And maybe eventually something comes up. And once we have that, then we can perhaps go further.
Okay, it's time to close up. There is the Slack channel where you're all invited to further ask questions to Hermann or disagree with him or make comments. And we will have a break now for half an hour. Indeed, and then at 11 o'clock, local Waterloo time, we will have the poster session, which we hope you all join again using Remo. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hermann, again for the talk.
Yep. Thank you.